All right, the time is 1:02 Central Time. Screen on January 11th, 2022, and I am convening this video conference meeting of the Assessment Investment Committee of the Board of Directors of the Texas and Life Health Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act and the Association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on December 30th, 2021 and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. A copy of the notice shall be attached to the summary of the official minutes. We do have a quorum. We have all the members of the Assessment Investment Committee. Also in attendance, we have Board Counsel Shelby Betts, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, Executive Director Bart Bowles, from the Association, Jarrett Terry and Topping Haggerty. And from TDI, we have John Peters and Brian Rewee. Have I left anybody out? All right. With that, Bart, I guess we'll just jump to item number one, action on the consent agenda. I don't know if committee members have had a chance to look at the minutes, but if so, I'd entertain a motion.
This is Ted. I'll make a motion to adopt the consent agenda.
All right. We have a motion. Dean, second.
Yeah, why not?
All right. A motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
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 All right. Motion carries. All right. Back to item number two, consideration and possible action on the association's cash flow projections. Bart or Jarrett?
So why don't you let me run with this, Jarrett? We're doing a little different projection. Instead of a presentation of the projections, instead of giving you all this narrative, we thought we'd just give you a table. And after drawing this up, I think we're going to expand this table. So we tell you what the benefits were in the prior year paid on these active insolvencies, what the benefits are projected for the coming year. And then we were going to add a column here that says remaining obligations after this current year. And I will just give you those numbers today. But to run through them quickly, you know, Pintrini and Anik is the largest health insolvency the Guarantee Association system has ever seen, with, you know, potential obligations around $3 billion. Just so you know, about $1.2 billion has already been paid. But the association funded its obligations to LTC Re, the captive, back in 2017, and the captive is running off and paying the benefits as they're due. So that $130 million we funded back in 2017 is still being used. And roughly we're almost halfway through that for the Texas covered policyholders. Lincoln Memorial Service, we only have about $65,000 of remaining obligations. We anticipate about $4,000 will be paid next year. These are death benefits as they occur, very small face amounts associated with pre-need burial contracts. National States, you can see we're paying $150,000, $175,000 a year. We have about $1.8 million in remaining obligations after 2022. Executive Life, you can see we're only paying between $50,000 to $60,000 a year of our remaining installment payments to Aurora. We have, after 2022, projected payments of about $335,000. Northwestern National, this is a runoff of one remaining policyholder. We are anticipating, we have about $335,000 left to pay to him. We're anticipating we're going to pay the full $500,000 statutory limit to him. Calanthe Mutual, paying about $50,000 a year in death benefits and cash surrenders for these policies that are administered in-house. And we anticipate after 2022, about another $775,000 will be paid. And Universal Life is a very small trickle, about $10,000 a year. These are life policies again. and we have about $253,000 remaining after 2022. The other on there is occasionally we have a lost policy or claim surface on a very old insolvency. Some of these are, for example, Kentucky Central. There were some paid up policies there that kind of got lost through two different assumptions. And after research, we have found sufficient documentation. These policies were in force and just got left out of the assumptions. So occasionally we'll pay a few death benefits or surrenders on some lost policies like that. So those are kind of the obligations. I will just give you a quick forecast. We're going to get the cash available needs schedule. We have funds for funding all of these with the exception of two, and they're very small. And we will get to that later on the agenda. But this agenda item is just a quick overview of the cash flow on benefit payments for the association. And in 2022, it's roughly estimated to be about $300,000.
Thank you, Bart. Any questions from committee members, Ted or Dean? All right, hearing none. Just jump to item number three, Lincoln Memorial Service Excess Funds.
Okay. This is going to be our most significant discussion item today, and it's going to be a bifurcated discussion. There's a summary that I'm going to run through and describe with these written materials that I've included in the meeting packet. That material's non-confidential information, and just going to summarize the issue here. There's going to be an additional discussion in executive session where we're going to ask Jackie to provide some additional legal guidance and advice. That is privileged information for the committee to consider. So you have one piece of written information in the public materials. We provide you with a second confidential document in advance of the meeting. So a lot of this discussion will be held in executive session. So let me begin to just summarize what's in this public information. And I'm not going to read through the material. I'm just going to tell you the intent here is described for you what remaining funds we have on hand for the Lincoln Memorial Service Life Insurance Company insolvencies. And as I mentioned, we only have about $68,000 remaining obligations. We have much more than that in funds. Quickly, I'll just say it's about $46.4 million. But I want to describe for you the sources and uses of funds throughout this insolvency that began in 2009. So the sources of funds are going to be premiums, assessments, estate distributions, and litigation recoveries. And I'll put this table up on screen, and I want to describe for you the important thing here is the timing of when we obtained these sources of funds. And I want to make a couple of quick distinctions on this table that's on screen. It's on page 3-2 of your materials if you have your hard copy. You look at the premiums, you can see the vast majority of the premiums were collected in the first 3 years of these insolvencies, 2009, 10, and 11, and this to trickle through after that. The estate distributions, these were assets that were on hand in excess of what the SDR needed to conduct the affairs of the receivership. There were also some substantial reinsurance commutations and settlements of reinsurance agreements. You can see there were four distributions to the association. It's really to all the guarantee associations. These are our pro rata share, 2010, 11, 12, and 13. And then the Class B assessments, we did four Class B assessments for Lincoln Memorial Service. In 2009, $35 million, 2011, $62 million, 2012, $14 million, and then $3 million in 2014. I didn't mention litigation recoveries because in the timing, they were the last source of funds. We didn't see our first litigation recovery until 2014. And if you can see, through 2013, we had collected $144.6 million Those were our total sources before we ever saw a litigation recovery. After, from 2014 forward, all we saw were litigation recoveries, with the exception of this trickle of premiums and the $3 million of Class B assessments. Now, if I can cut ahead to the uses of funds, I think you will see why we had to do this $3 million assessment and why I've made this distinction between 2013 and then 2014 forward. So on this table in the uses of funds, there are really four categories. And the fourth one, the remaining obligations, I've already mentioned. We have 68,000 roughly we haven't paid yet in death benefits. Admin expenses, they are what they are. It's the cost of administering and being involved in this insolvency. Those are our in-house expenses, our counsel expenses, and counsel expenses of the NOLGA task force, and our litigation expenses. Then the direct benefit payments. These are benefit payments that were calculated by the special deputy receiver. We funded those and were paid out by the receiver as our administrator, roughly our TPA on these death claims. Then we have the assumption reinsurance payments. There were really two assumption reinsurance agreements, one in 2011. That was the $94 million payment that moved all of the memorial service policies. Their memorial service was only licensed in Texas, so it was this association's obligation entirely. And then in 2017, there was an assumption for some Lincoln Memorial policies that was done by all of the guarantee associations. We had a small piece of that. It was roughly $1 million. The other four assumption payments on here were true-ups of these two assumption agreements as additional policies were found and additional transfers had to be made. So we've paid $25.8 million in admin expenses, $37 million in direct benefits, $95 million in assumption. So with those remaining obligations we have, it's roughly $158 million. That's in total. But let me make the distinction here in 2013, as I mentioned. Through 2013, we had paid out $142.2 million in admin expenses and benefits. And remember that, 142.2. If I go back to the sources of funds through 2013, we had collected 144.6. So we had almost used all of our sources of funds. And if you look now at the uses of funds, you can see that the admin expenses continued substantially after that point. Why? Well, this was litigation expense to pursue our litigation case. And so the extra $3 million we assessed and the litigation recoveries funded these additional admin expenses and benefit payments from 2014 forward. So what this demonstrates is a prime example of what happens in a liquidation and receivership. There are the need for the funds to administer the obligations, to pay the benefits that are due to the policyholders we protect, and then pursue recoveries. And those recoveries may be many years down the road. And that's exactly what happened here. But when you lump together the sources and uses of fund at this point in time, and I've made a simple calculation here on the top of page 3-4. We have $46.4 million. Those are the remaining funds we have on hand. And that's after the 68,000, almost 69,000 remaining obligations. So you can say that these remaining funds, we have to address their disposition. The insurance code provides specific statutory authority and guidance, and it's very broad guidance on handling remaining funds. That's one thing we're going to ask specifically for Jackie to address in executive session. But I'll summarize the options for handling remaining funds. And I'll mention first, credit refunding. This is the most common practice that the association has done when we have remaining funds in an insolvency that are in excess of the obligations we forecast. So when we do a Class A or Class B assessment, we look back at that amount of money that's in that is remaining on that insolvency, and we allocate it to each member company that paid an assessment for that insolvency. So it's a pro rata allocation based on the assessment payments. So that belongs to each company. Let's say ABC company has $50,000 coming from the remaining funds on one insolvency. When we do a Class A or Class B assessment, company ABC will be sent an amount due. Let's say they owe $100,000. The assessment amount will be shown as $100,000. A credit refund of $50,000 will be applied, and they will be asked to make a net payment of the $50,000. The credit refund will be moved in-house from as we have it allocated to that company to the Class B funds for the new insolvency that is being assessed. Now, that's a simple situation of one insolvency and a credit refund from one company. We've done credit refunds on dozens and dozens of companies. There are the situations when you do a credit refund, the amount being refunded is greater than the assessment obligation for the company. And we hold that credit refund balance. We have 3.96 million of credit refund balances we're holding right now, and that's spread across each company's share, and that's 250 member companies that have a share of that 3.96 million. So it's a lot of tracking. If you look at one company's share, it may be for a credit refund from 25 different insolvencies. So there is some complexity here that I've not included in the report, but it is a very straightforward, detailed tracking. But this is our most common practice, credit refund in association with a Class A or Class B assessment. The next method is a direct refund. To say, here are the monies that were collected for Lincoln Memorial that are now remaining, and let's refund that to the companies that paid assessments for Lincoln Memorial, and it would be refunded in proportion to their pro rata share of the assessment payments. The problem is there's a statutory restriction that any company that's taken a premium tax offset for a portion or all those funds is not entitled to that refund. It must be paid to the Commissioner of Insurance. So for the $114 million that has been assessed as Class B assessment for Lincoln Memorial Moral Service, the second paragraph here on page 3-5, you will see that there's $527,384.78 of remaining offsets yet to be taken by 74 member companies from those $114 million of assessments. So we have a list from the comptroller. We know precisely of each one of those 74 companies how much of that 527,000 they've not yet taken. So of this 46 million that we have of remaining funds, 45.8 will be paid to the Commissioner of Insurance under the direct refunding method. And then the last two methods, the board could decide, let's just use these funds rather than doing an allocation of credit refund to Class A to offset administrative expenses. Let's just say the administrative expenses the association needs this year are $2 million. Let's just pay the $2 million from those funds. Rather than do it as a credit refund, just take it off just directly. That's one way. We can talk more about that later. The same way, some of these funds could be applied just to eliminate the need to do an assessment, a Class B assessment for an insolvent company. So it's not an allocation on a pro rata basis. It's just reduce the total needed, either Class A or Class B. And then finally, you could do a combination of any or all of these. Use some to eliminate the need to do a Class A assessment, and then hold the rest to be done as a credit refund, or do a direct refund of some. The combination is there. So And Jackie will describe the authority later, and there is a little bit more language that may need to be considered. So what's the timeline on these funds for dealing with these funds? The largest litigation recovery was just received back in September. It's $29 million. And until we had the time to gather the information for the committee to consider, we went ahead and invested in treasuries that would mature in the end of September 2022. And I believe Jarrett told me with that $29 million, there's another $2 million of Lincoln funds maturing at the same time. So there's $31 million of Lincoln funds maturing September 30th, 2022. There are some Lincoln Memorial funds invested in treasuries that will mature prior to that date. And there are some invested that will mature after that date. So that before and after piece is about $15 million. So all of the Lincoln Memorial funds right now are invested in treasuries and earning interest. Okay. So that's a very quick summary of what are these remaining funds? How did we get here? There are a number of options how to address them. And in the timeline, I should say, the intent was to begin to introduce this topic and have a discussion with the committee to see if there's additional information you would like to review and evaluate, or if you want counsel to look at authority questions. Between now and July, your next meeting. But our goal was to implement some type of resolution during calendar year 2022. There is no prescribed timeline that you must adhere to. We just think this would be prudent. And I'll stop there and ask, before I ask the committee for questions that can be handled in an open session, Jackie or Jarrett, is there anything here that you feel we should discuss in open session?
I think you covered it, Bart.
Yes, I have nothing else to offer.
Jim or the committee, if you have anything you'd like to ask a question now, and I'll tell you if I can answer at this point or wait until executive session.
Yeah. Thanks, Bart. Very informative. I don't think I have any other questions for open session. I guess I might for Jackie. When we go into executive session, Tad or Dean, any questions for Bart in open session?
Not so far.
All right.
Same for me.
Okay.
So Jim, the only thing that we've not had the opportunity, we might ask our colleagues from TDI, John or Brian, if they have a question, because we're going to have to excuse them in executive session.
I don't have any.
No question for me.
Okay.
All right. Yep. Thank you, Bart. I should have asked that. All right. Well, more discussion in executive session, but now let's roll to item four, Bart. Investments.
Okay. Some of this material you've seen before, but we do have some additional information that the committee asked us to gather. And I hate to say it, but some of it's not in your material because it's been hard to find. We just got it. So, Jarrett, do you want to cover this? Or you want me to go ahead and do it?
I can cover it. Okay. Sorry, I'm fighting something today, so it's coming across the horse. So, as you know, we invest all of our cash in a cash account. It's not to exceed $250,000 U.S. Treasury bills and notes and money market funds that are invested in 100% U.S. Treasuries. So on the next page, we have a schedule of where those funds are allocated between the three different methods. And the first one is the cash and money markets. And so the first box there is the Morgan Stanley money market funds at October 31st and November 30th. Second box there is the J.P. Morgan. The negative numbers are due to mostly just a timing issue. These are a snapshot at the end of the month. But if you know, as you recall, we've explained before that, you know, we have treasuries moving in and out of these money market funds as they mature and as we invest. And so sometimes they're negative. And then whenever the security or the treasury matures, it'll pay it back and it'll be positive. So it's just really just a timing issue. Excuse me. The third box there is our cash at JP Morgan. Like I said, we never exceed 250,000. Those are set up to sweep into those JP Morgan money market funds overnight. And then we go into the next box, which are next two boxes, which are investments in treasuries. The first one at Morgan Stanley and the second one at JP Morgan. And we have those designated between the expense funds, Lincoln Memorial funds, the Penn Treaty funds, and all the other estate funds. So add those all up and we end up with the balance in all investments of $67,068,349 at the end of November.
So, Jerry, before you go on, I want to point to the committee. I'm going to go through box by box and show you some Lincoln Memorial balances. So the cash and money market, Morgan Stanley, you see the $1.158 million. Then go down the money market at JP Morgan. That's at negative 4.1. That's, I call them investments in transit. So they're in process of being invested and moved. But if you add the 1.158, subtract the 4.1, go down here to the U.S. Treasuries, Lincoln Memorial at Morgan Stanley, 32.9 million, add that. And then the JP Morgan's Treasuries, and you add 16.68 million, you do get 46.536 million. That's a little bit different than the total we just went over with you in the prior agenda item. And Jarrett, I believe that's a function of mark to market. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So these values of the treasuries on Lincoln Memorial are at market value. The number that we provided you before is strictly a cash number, cash in, cash out. And so these treasuries are sitting there at a market value that's going to fluctuate month to month. And so it'll be a little bit different than the number that we provided earlier. And you'll see on the cash available needs schedule that they'll be a little bit different there, because that also includes the market value plus some other non-cash items such as accrued interest and intercompany loans. But they're all really close numbers. And the net, the cash available needs schedule number is probably the most accurate at November 30th.
And we'll be getting there. So any questions on these investments before we talk to you about some yields?
Nothing for me. Any other members of the committee?
No, I'm okay. Looks
good to me.
All right. Go ahead, okay. Bart.
So this schedule is, and at the top here, we're giving you some, as of December 17th, some returns and yields on treasury bills and current certificates of deposit. We're going to come back to that because we have something to compare to. But this schedule of treasuries, that's that 64,601,374 actually was shown on the prior page. The market value of all our laddered treasuries. We have maturities. We had some that just matured year end 21. And you can see these are quarterly maturities. And most of the time it's set up for a every quarter. I think we've set it up, Jared, about 2 million maturing. There are some quarters that are higher. And what that is, or really, if you look at September 30th, 2022, that's that litigation recovery we just had. And we put it out to September 30th, 2022 maturity. Anything on this schedule we should point out, Jarrett?
Yeah, so the last two columns there are something new this meeting that we've not added before. And this was in response to Dean asking us to look into possible ways to increase our yield. So in order to do that, we have to know the yield of the portfolio that we have. And so this has been added. This is yield to maturity, since we typically hold all of our treasuries to maturity. So that's the most accurate measure. And the first column there is the individual security yield. And then the second column is the weighted average yield based on market value. So the overall yield on this portfolio is 1.26%.
Okay. And Dean also asked us to do some exploration in the, I call it the Cedars program. It is no longer called the Cedars program. I have to look at the list and make sure I get this the name of this
thing. It's the IntraFi Deposit Program, Network Deposit Program.
Thank you. So it's under a new name, but even when you talk to the banks, they still call it the Cedars Program. What's interesting is some of the banks that were participating that we have been talking to no longer participate. So Jarrett was finally able to get a participating bank to respond just last Friday and get us the quote on some CD rates through the Cedars program. And Jared, I'm just going to read off some of it. And I'm going to put this schedule up here so you can see how the rates I'm about to read compare to Treasuries and current CD rates. So let's start with, let's do 26 weeks. So right here, 180 days, roughly, it would compare to 26 weeks through the Cedars program. 0.10 annual percentage. And you can see here, it's 0.45 under CDs purchased directly and 0.13 under Treasuries. Go to 1 year, Cedars is 0.15, 1 year into Treasuries, 0.27, and directly purchased CDs, 0.55. Let's go on and look at 2 year, and that's as far as the Treasuries go, so I'll stop there. But 2 years under Cedars, 0.20%. 2 years under Treasuries, 0.66. Under the current direct purchase CDs, 2 years is 0.60. So you can see the rates on Treasuries and the rates on directly purchased CDs are significantly higher than that offered through the Cedars program, and our current yield of 1.26 for our entire portfolio. And then that 2024 is going out 3 years. I'll go and tell you that 3 years under the Cedars program is 0.30. So if we're just concerned with yield, the Cedars program does not meet our current investments. The advantage is you invest with one entity and you get one statement. That entity breaks up because you can invest up to, I think, Jarrett, $150 million. Is that correct?
That's correct.
$150 million through Cedars. And then the bank you work with then goes and purchases CDs within FDIC limits at a myriad of banks and provides you with one statement. But through all that, you can see you're sacrificing significant yield. Now, I hope I haven't misstated that, Jarrett. Does that sound accurate?
No, that's the information we got.
And Director Frigo, is that the information you wanted to hear?
Yeah, well, if you're comparing the 2 year to the 2 year, you'd be giving up 6 basis points, if I'm reading this right.
Well, and that's right with current CDs, but that's a directly purchased CD. If you do 2 years through Cedars, it's 0.20%.
So you're giving up 46 basis points.
Giving up 46 basis points.
The CD rates, on the chart and I don't see it.
It's not on the chart because we didn't get that till Friday. The chart is directly purchased CDs, not CDs through the Cedars program.
Dean, it was incredibly difficult to find a bank to quote CD rates or to quote Cedar rates. Most of the banks I contacted participate in the program, but they do not initiate the CDs. So I finally found a small local bank in Houston that would initiate the CDs and provide me with a rate sheet. So I just got that on Friday.
Is there a yield out there in anything?
There's not a lot. Let me stop there. That's a summary of investments. I don't want to get off into investment policy. Any other questions on the investments or the, as you can see, the $67 million the association is holding in cash and investments?
Sounds like we're better off where we're at. Any other questions for Ted or Dean?
No, thanks for doing that.
And Dean, it's something that we can periodically revisit. I'm not saying we're going to do it all the time because it's a lot of time and effort to chase these people, but periodically we will look at it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for checking that out, Bart and Jarrett. Item five, kind of a review of the investment policy.
And this isn't something in your charter. They annually, you should look at the investment policy. And I think it's very apropos with the current level of funds the association is holding currently. You have a robust but conservative investment policy. I have done some talking with other associations, and many of them have much more liberal investment policies and are achieving some higher returns. So we could explore some other opportunities, but it seems that the safeguards and the guardrails that the association and its board has put around its investments many years ago and continue to maintain have served it very well. And there are returns, they're not significant, but returns are being achieved. The one thing that Jarrett and I tend to practice is don't ask for the money until we need it. Leave it in the member company's hands. That's the best way to invest the money. Don't take it from them. But there are funds that we hold, and we may want to explore some additional investment opportunities. Now, I say that, and then there's a couple of approaches that we could do this. One is I could gather and collect some investment policies from other entities and compare and contrast and say, here's how they differ. The thing I found in working with all those companies is, and there, some of those are guarantee associations as well, it's not just their investment policy. They're using investment managers. Because to really achieve the yields, you need to have someone that can spend the time and effort to achieve and obtain the yields. I'm sorry to say, I'm not a full-time investor. Oh, my degree's in finance. I'm not a full-time investor, and it would take some time and effort that honestly I can't spare right now. So if you would like to explore the expansion of the investment policy, we can gather some information, but I would urge you to implement it. It'd be worth possibly engaging an investment manager. And I'm not trying to back away from doing work. I just think that's the wise way to do it.
Yeah, Bart, this is Dean. I don't think there's any yield out there to be had. So it's probably a discussion for another day, but right now it looks like we're getting all we can get.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Bart, it's Ted. I just offer, to the extent we want to do an analysis just to compare ourselves, I would limit that to other state guarantee associations and not associations in general. I don't know that that's what you had done initially or not, but I think we sit in a little different chair than other general associations with respect to our fund and the purpose of the guarantee association. So I think it would be a best practice for us to periodically check peer group, but limit that to state guarantee associations.
I think that's a very appropriate direction, Ted. All right, Ted, I had talked to a couple of guarantee associations, but I also tried to obtain some information from nonprofits. But you know, a lot of nonprofits, based on how they obtain their funds and their membership, completely different function. And it's really apples to oranges. So I would like to do a little bit of an exploration into what other guarantee associations' investment policies look like.
All right. I assume you can do that under your time constraints, Bart, and limiting it to other GAs.
It's a couple of simple phone calls and arm twists. I think that's not too bad. Actually, I had this conversation in some regional virtual meetings of guarantee associations we've had, and a couple have already shared with me. So I already have a couple.
Well, I guess I agree with Ted. Just a best practice, it's good to take a look whether or not we ultimately decide to make any changes is, I guess, a separate issue. But it might be worthwhile to see what's out there if it doesn't take up too much of your time.
Okay. And with all that being said, I should have led with this. We're not making any recommendations today that you change your investment policy. It's just a recommendation if you want to explore it, a method to explore it.
I'm sorry, Shelby, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I was just going to add the Texas Property Casualty GA has two money managers, but they have $500 million of assets to invest. But usually what the pitch that gets made by the money managers is, you know, this is kind of, we're offloading the duties of, you know, a small staff, in your case, Bart, 3-person, possibly 4-person staff. And, you know, the board can argue that we're, you know, we're in charge of managing these big sums of money and we are letting experts do that. So, I mean, I think it's worth exploring, but you need to find out what the costs are.
Yeah.
And I will say TPC is not making jillions of dollars for its member companies. I think Dean is correct that the yield is kind of low out there. So
I'm assuming even if we went outside that it would still be pretty conservative, whatever we would do. So, yeah.
Jim, I think also, the most unconservative or venturesome for TPC is they invest in a fair number of corporate bonds.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I've seen that in some of the others that they have a bond portfolio.
Right.
Jim, you may have seen in the annual meeting of LTC Re that was conducted back in October, LTC Re, when they took these $3 billion from the Guaranty Associations for the runoff of the Penn Treaty business, one of the primary reasons of setting that captive up is to try to achieve some yields that Guaranty Associations individually can't and trim the cost of that insolvency over the length of the runoff over time. And we know that, yes, if we've got $60 million to invest, there's a list of investments out there available to us. If you've got $3 billion to invest, that list is a little longer. There are more institutional investments available to you. The money manager for LTC Re is achieving around a 5% return. Okay. They are seeing a little bit more, but they have a lot of money to invest and they it's full-time and then some. I mean, they're doing a lot of work on it. But we can also look at that as well.
Yeah, I don't think there's any harm. Yeah, checking out the other GAs. And then anyway, based on what you find, we can decide if we want to pursue it further. So, okay. Any other questions from committee members or?
Just a thought. If it's not too difficult, Bart, I might also ask as you're checking peer group what their philosophy is with regard to funds. You've already identified, as we know, with the Texas Association, you try not to hold funds when you don't have to. You don't pull the money until you need it, and when you need it, you use it. So there's not a whole lot of money on account. Granted, we have this surplus now due to Lincoln, but that's typically not the case. I would be interested to know not only what the investment provisions are for the other associations that you pull, but also, is that the same philosophy, or do other associations typically hold out those dollars and therefore they end up having more assets to invest long-term than perhaps the Texas Association, or are they all trying their best to only ask for what they need, and when they don't need it, they give it back or spend it?
That's a good point, Ted. And I will definitely use that focus. I will tell you, when I put our assessment history beside another Guaranty Association's assessment history, the one thing that jumps off the page is since 1992, not every year, but I think only maybe 4 or 5 years since 1992, we have not done a credit refund. Almost every time that assessment's been done, there's been a refund done at the same time. And that is not the, has not been the common practice across the Guaranty Association world.
I think some associations, or I guess I'm thinking of one in particular, is it kind of administering its own claims in-house rather than sending them out. So I think they're sitting on some additional funds too. So I know they do some investing, but their situation would be a little different than ours.
So. Yeah, that's my point. In my experience, other associations may be more inclined to do so. And if that's the case, it may make more sense to have a money manager since you're managing that in-house. If you're a Texas association that tries not to have money in-house, the advantage of a manager is perhaps mitigated, but just a consideration.
Agree with that. All right. If there's nothing else, then let's go to item number 6, consideration of a possible Class A assessment.
Okay. If I may, for the committee, just to kind of present to you a snapshot of where we are on expense funds at year end. It's actually November 30th, this most recent period closed. Jared is just now closing year end. And where we project we will be at year end 2022. This is following in the philosophy of the committee to forecast and assess for Class A annually based on current funds, projected needs, and those needs roughly come from our administrative, which we call our operating budget for the next calendar year. What I have on screen here is the pro forma cash flow of where we are right now at November 30th. And you can see with the credit balances of the 3.9 million we're holding that belong to member companies, we'd have a deficit of $143,000. How does that compare to the last couple of years? In 2021, we had a surplus of operating expenses of $680,000. And in 2020, we had a deficit of $612,000. So it you can forecast all you like, but what happens in the year may not have been something known at the time of your forecast. So $143,000 projected deficit, and we look at our expenses for 2022. Our rent and employee benefits are fairly easy to project. The other office expenses, Jarrett, why don't you make a couple comments about what's included in that?
Okay, Bart, sorry, can you scroll down a little bit?
Yes, I'm sorry. Right there.
So other office expenses are going to be rent, our, you know, things such as postage, all the things like that. This also includes, our estimated NOLGA MPC bills for the various insolvencies that don't have any funds to pay, such as SHIP and the global companies. So all that's included in that other office expenses.
So let me add a clarification, because that's where I wanted Jared to go with this. When we're talking about the MPC task force expenses for those type companies, those are companies that are subject to some type of rehabilitation proceeding. It's a monitoring, we're preparing, but we do not have the ability to assess Class B. So those things are paid from Class A, what we call non-insolvency specific, because it's not an insolvency for which we've been activated. And if you look year to year, like I looked at the last 2 years, those other office expenses in 2021 was $635,000. In 2020, it was $576,000. It's a little bit up. We're projecting in 2022, and a lot of that's because of the money we're spending on SHIP, and we don't anticipate that that's going to be a company we can do a Class B assessment for in the near future. So with the deficit and with these projected non-insolvency specific Class A funds, we think we're going to have a deficit at year end 2022 of $1.87 million. And I wanted to present this and then wait to take any action on it. We do have in your materials a suggested resolution for you to consider a Class A assessment, but I would like Chair Harrison to postpone taking action on anything there until after we have our executive session discussion.
Understood. I think those items will dovetail, so we'll take it up. It seems like we'll need to do something, but we'll take it up after executive session.
But I do want the committee to have the opportunity to ask any questions about the difference in Class A and operating and our approach. Any questions about the numbers?
Doesn't sound like it, Bart.
Okay.
All right, jump to item seven, Class B.
This is really the item we go over with you twice a year. And when we do Class B assessment credit refund, well, we're just telling you, do we need money? Do we have money? And it all boils down to our old friend right here, class available needs, the cash available needs schedule. It tells you the net position of each active insolvency. And we start with cash and cash equivalents, receivables, and things that other assets that we may realize we do not have yet. And what we have as payables, what we forecast in any remaining obligations, either for expenses or for policy benefits. So if you go down this list, the numbers are fairly small. I mentioned a couple, $654,000 deficit for Calanthe Mutual. That's a company you have never assessed for. But if you'll note, we have, Jared, is this correct? $168,000 available on Calanthe?
Yes, that's the cash that's available, excuse me, on Calanthe.
And the 823 of payables, those are the obligations. We only are forecasting about 50,000 of that will become due in 2022. So is there the need to assess all of this right now? No. And Jared, if I say something you don't agree with, you can always tell me.
Okay.
Some of these positive numbers you'll see, Consumers United, Diamond Benefit, Executive Life, First Columbia, First National Life. These are smaller balances, but there are monies that we could lump together and do a credit refund when the next Class B assessment is done. But so I'm looking for Class B needs here in Freestone and Golden State. Freestone was a company for which we were never activated. There was some research there we had to do into the obligations themselves and into licensing. So we did spend some money, but we never had any obligations. We were never activated. So this is at some point the next time we utilize the insolvency expense account to wipe out some of these, we may need to address it. Golden State, small balance, here we go. Some more positives again. And then the large one, $47.65 million for Lincoln Memorial. So I will go to the next one of a negative, the $640,000 for Northwestern National. These were for some task force expenses and the obligations we are forecasting remaining for the loan policyholder. We think we're going to end up paying what we've already paid plus additional benefits to pay the full statutory limit to that policyholder. So about $640,000, we have not assessed for it yet. But again, we're only at a deficit of $51,000 right now. And I believe, Jarrett, we're paying out about $40,000 a year on him.
I think around 50.
50, okay. So at this point, we're not recommending a Class B assessment. an internal in-house borrowings can be used to meet those obligations. And then let me go to SHIP, Southland National, and Time. Those three companies with the deficit, all three of those are rehabilitations where we have a NOLGA task force. We're funding the expenses of the task force to monitor and explore whether those will become obligations. We are not triggered for them yet. We recommend to continue to borrow internally to pay for those. And then if activated, we would assess Class B and repay those borrowings. So to sum it up, all these amounts are manageable, and we recommend continue to be tracked. Any obligations that we do not have funds specifically for that company that we address through internal borrowings, but we are not recommending a Class B assessment or credit refund at this time.
Thank you, Bart and Jarrett. No questions for me. Ted or Dean, anything for Bart or Jarrett?
Nope, sounds good.
Hearing none, I guess that brings us to item 8. And I can sign us out, and then I'll ask if we want to take a quick break or not. But we're ready to wrap this up, Bart. I can read the language.
Please do.
All right. The time is 1:59 p.m. Central Time on January 11, 2022, and I am recessing the regular session of the Assessment Investment Committee meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Guarantee Association in order for the committee to meet in executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act.
We are recording in public session.
All right. The time is 3 p.m. Central Time on January 11, 2022, the executive session of the Assessment Investment Committee meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association has concluded, and I am reconvening the regular session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. So Bart, I think we have a couple items arising out of executive session.
Do we need to bring TDI back in?
Yeah.
Good point. Thank you, Jarrett. Welcome back, John Peters.
Hey, Bart, Brian is in another meeting, but he may be able to join. Should I tell him to join, or do you think it's about
over? There's not much left. There's a couple of resolutions, and then we're just going to talk about the date of the next meeting. There's not much left.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, Chair Harrison.
All right. I think we're on item 9, consideration of possible action on items discussed in the executive session. So I think the first item is a resolution on the handling of the remaining Lincoln Memorial Service funds. And there's a proposed resolution on the screen. If you want to take a look, and I'll entertain a motion.
This is Dean. I'll move the resolution.
Ted, second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All right. That resolution passes unanimously. And then I think we have a Class A item to handle as well. All right, I think Bart put up the resolution for a Class A assessment on the screen. I think the amount is open at this point. Somebody wants to make a motion.
This is Dean. I'll move we make a $2 million Class A assessment.
Ted seconds.
All right, any further discussion? All right, all in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
So Chair aye. Harrison, on this Class A assessment, I wanted to let the committee know that this is the first assessment that we are attempting to do as a virtual assessment where we do not send hard copy invoices to the member companies to the extent we can. There'll be a few companies we don't have good electronic contact information. With that, the March 1st distribution date that we've always targeted may slip a little bit. It may go out in early April. But I think that slippage in time is well worth it to do this on a virtual basis.
That doesn't, I presume, cause any concern on your end, timing-wise. So,
no.
No problem on mine. All right. Any other items arising out of executive session? I think that covers it. And if so, that brings us to item number 10, consideration of committee's next meeting.
And I will tell you there on screen is the targeted date from our calendar activities. That will be Tuesday, July 12th.
All right. Are we just going to wait and see, Bart, if we're going to do it online or in, well, I guess, would this be in advance of the actual board meeting? Or two, it says I right. I answered my question 2 weeks before. So
yeah, this what would be tried to do, what we've tried to do now, Jim, with the advancements we've made in virtual meetings is go ahead and schedule the committee meetings 2 weeks in advance of the board meeting. And it makes pulling together the board materials so much easier and to get, if there's any additional research or work to do. And with that, we've kind of targeted having the committee meetings as virtual. Yep. Where we always had them coupled together as everything in person. So it had to be the day before. Yep.
No, that makes a lot of sense to me, Bart. I just didn't read the last paragraph quickly enough. All right, anything else from the committee?
I'll just say July 12th, there's an ACLI legal meeting on that we'll be in the middle of 11th through the 13th, and then an NQL meeting beginning the 13th. The ACLI is in Florida and the NQL is in New Jersey. I will probably be at one or both of those. So if we do it virtually, I have no problem. If it's an in-person, I may not be there, be in Texas on the 12th.
Right. Virtual would be certainly easier for me. I wouldn't want to fly in for a, even COVID permitting, for a committee meeting, I guess, for an hour or so, or 2 hours.
Same here.
If you need to shift that, we could always shift it.
Yeah, if there are dates that work better, Ted, let Bart know and we can check with the committee.
Yeah, I'm actually, I guess my preference would be to do it virtually, and the 12th is fine, but if there's need to be in person, then I would defer to any of the consecutive Tuesdays thereafter.
Okay. Now, I think we'll target virtually and try to hold it on the 12th.
Yep. I agree. That works for me. Okay. Anything else from committee members or council or the association? All right. Hearing none. The time is 3:07 Central Time on January 11, 2022, and this meeting of the Assessment Investment Committee of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association is hereby adjourned.